patients with psychiatric comorbidity clearly are at increased risk for adverse events if they were to discontinue medication treatment for opioid use disorder.
And I think more specifically, this opens up the issue of maintenance, long-term maintenance treatment, and who are the candidates for long-term maintenance treatment, and identifying them and developing that as a concept among the wide range of prescribers of buprenorphine.
That's Dr. Arthur Robin Williams and Dr. Mark Olson, who will talk about the research on adverse health outcomes among individuals with opioid use disorder following the stoppage of treatment with the medication buprenorphine. Their work appears in the February 2020 issue of the American Journal of Psychiatry. I'm Michael Roy, executive editor of the American Journal of Psychiatry, and this is AJP Audio. Dr. Arthur Robin Williams is an assistant professor of clinical psychiatry at the Columbia University Division of Substance Use Disorders and a research scientist at the New York State Psychiatric Institute. His research has focused broadly on addiction psychiatry, and more specifically, his work aims to develop a quality of care framework in the context of opioid use disorder, as well as on investigating the use of controlled substances among medical marijuana participants and the related risk of overdose. Dr. Mark Olson is the Elizabeth K. Dollar Professor of Psychiatry, Medicine, and Law, and Professor of Epidemiology at Columbia University Medical Center. He is also a research scientist at the New York State Psychiatric Institute. His work has looked at patterns and trends in the use of mental health care services and on quality of care. In particular, he aims to identify gaps between clinical science and practice with a focus on suicide prevention and improving the treatment of adults with serious mental illness and substance use disorders. Dr. Williams and Dr. Olson are co-authors of the lead article in our February issue, Acute Care, Prescription Opioid Use, and Overdose Following Discontinuation of Long-Term Buprenorphine Treatment for Opioid Use Disorder. Dr. Williams, Dr. Olson, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Nice to be here with you.
Now, your article begins by noting that buprenorphine, which the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved in 2002 for the treatment of opioid dependence, is the most frequently prescribed medication for opioid use disorder in the United States. However, a majority of patients who begin treatment with this medication are not retained in care. So, first, could you talk about how buprenorphine helps patients, and then go over some of the factors that undermine the long-term use of this medication?
Sure. So buprenorphine, as you have pointed out, has been on the market for about 17 years now. And we think that, that the estimates typically suggest that there are 700 or 800,000 individuals in a given year who receive it. Some estimates suggest it may even be closer to 1 million people over the course of a year. And it helps to treat opioid use disorder by stabilizing the opioid receptors, in particular in the central nervous system in the brain. It addresses withdrawal completely, so patients aren't in withdrawal. It reduces cravings and urges to use opioids, reduces events of using opioids, the likelihood of relapse, and it also maintains a high tolerance at the opioid receptors so that if someone were to use small amounts or even medium amounts of opioids, they really wouldn't feel the effects, and it also, that blockade, that tolerance blockade confers protection against respiratory suppression or overdose risk among individuals if they were to return to active opioid use while on buprenorphine. And it is Schedule 3 rather than Schedule 2, like methadone, because in general, the use of buprenorphine on its own doesn't lead to overdose the way that methadone or a Schedule 2 drug like oxycodone could. And so for that reason, it was approved to be used in the outpatient setting under the office-based opioid treatment or OBOT process, where any physician, and now in most states, any nurse with an X waiver from the DEA is allowed to provide buprenorphine to patients for the treatment of opioid use disorder and for the long-term maintenance of opioid use disorder. So, Michael, you were also asking about what's happening in terms of so many patients receive this medication that really is the gold standard treatment for opioid use disorder, and yet we also know that these patients typically only stay in care for a few weeks or a few months. And depending on what kind of study you're looking at, what kind of data set, what kind of clinical setting, in general, it seems as though at least half of the patients have dropped out of care within 2 to 4 weeks In some programs, they have better, relatively better retention, where patients might remain in care for 3 months or 6 months. But in general, the great majority of patients are gone within 6 to 12 months. And there are a lot of reasons for this. It's not just patient-level factors. Clearly, patients who have more chaotic lives, who have worse social determinants of health, who may have more comorbidities, physical and psychiatric comorbidities, may be at greater risk of discontinuing earlier. That's intuitive. But there are a lot of structural provider, system, and policy-level barriers, frankly, that also make it extremely difficult for patients to remain in care. Some of these include states where there hasn't been Medicaid expansion. We know that in Medicaid expansion states that there are higher rates of buprenorphine prescribing and patients have easier access to it. We know that in states, for instance, like New York, where they have done away with prior authorizations and all of these utilization management techniques that insurance plans put into place, our public plans, our Medicaid plans have done away with those prior authorizations, which has made it easier for patients to access buprenorphine and to stay on it without having a 6 month or 12 month renewal for authorization for reimbursement for buprenorphine. We also know that there are a lot of providers and a lot of treatment programs, even specialized addiction treatment programs, that erroneously believe that patients should only be on buprenorphine for a short term. So they might use it just for a 1 week detox or for a 1 month transition to help patients transition off of heroin. But the reality is patients who have been injecting, you know, 6 or 8 bags of heroin for months or for years, 1 month of buprenorphine treatment isn't nearly sufficient. And a lot of, if you're thinking about a root source in terms of all of these different levels of reasons that patients run into barriers, one of those root sources really is stigma. And there's a lot of misinformation and a lot of misunderstanding from providers, from family members, and from other patients trying to enter recovery. And I think often these patients face a lot of resistance and hostility to the ongoing use of buprenorphine because some people might say or charge that those patients aren't truly in recovery. And it's a major problem.
Well, it sounds like there are a lot of factors, obviously, that affect access and retention. And these factors must also play a role in things like guidelines for the use of this medication. Are there any quality measures for buprenorphine or for the treatment of opioid use disorder more generally?
So it's a great question, and it dovetails with a lot of my academic and professional work, and it was part of what motivated our study design from the outset. So last summer, I was at a NIDA, an NIH Clinical Trials Network meeting for NIDA, which is the National Institute on Drug Abuse. And we were discussing, long-term studies, and at the same time, I was going to a bunch of APA technical expert panel meetings because I'm on a technical expert panel for the NCQA, which is a measure development body, as well as the National Quality Forum. And the NQF either endorses or declines to endorse these quality measures that are developed. And CMS looks directly to NQF's guidance in terms of which measures to potentially incorporate into the core measure sets that helps guide Medicaid and Medicare plans, which of course has trickle-down effects to commercial plans as well. And I believe it was the summer of 2018 that the NQF did endorse a very new measure that the RAND Corporation helped develop that was looking at continuity of pharmacotherapy for opioid use disorder. And what they, in general, what they were suggesting was that the way the measure was specified is that patients who receive, in this case, buprenorphine, should receive it for continuously for 180 days without a gap of more than 7 days during that 6 month period. And when we looked at all of the good work that went into making that well-intentioned measure, what we saw, which was not really a surprise because we're familiar with the literature in this area, what we saw is that the measure was not empirically based. They didn't have, you know, a list of studies that empirically showed that 6 months was the minimal duration necessary to confer long-term benefits. Rather, it really drew from two things. One was expert consensus, and the other is the standard of care. And the reality, as I was saying initially, the standard of care in our communities is so poor that the great majority of patients don't make it to 6 months. It would actually be a revolution in our standard of care if we could get the average patient to 6 months or longer. So that's a lot of backstory, but all of those things were kind of in the air about a year ago when we decided to put this study design together. because the measures that we do have are very few, and in general, they're not empirically informed. And so this study was designed to contribute, to create and to contribute to that literature so that our quality measures can point to very concrete data in terms of what minimal durations of care are necessary for patients to really have long-term benefit, even those patients who discontinue treatment eventually.
Well, indeed, and your referencing the literature leads me to consider the current status of research in this area. Now, your article in our February issue notes that prior studies of long-term buprenorphine treatment tend to focus on general outcomes, so things like overall service use and psychosocial functioning. What might be lacking in the literature is information on outcomes that are pertinent to particular disorders, like opioid use or overdose. So what did you hope to achieve in your study?
Well, you know, I think one of the things is that this study was looking at acute adverse events that are perhaps more serious than some of those that are followed in traditional clinical trials. So while clinical trials may focus on things like opioid-positive urines, this study focused on acute events like hospitalization and emergency department visits related to substance use or even more specifically to opioids. And so we're trying to take advantage of the fact that within these larger claims-based studies, what we thought would be rare outcomes can be measured with certainty and that you can have enough of them that you can get a sense of their patterns.
So I think part of what Dr. Olson is pointing out is that there are really, in general, you could think of two categories of studies that look at the treatment for opioid use disorder. And one is the, you know, the gold standard prospective randomized controlled trial that's double-blinded or that's open label, but where in general you have patients with OUD coming in for treatment for 12 weeks. And they might be followed up for up to 6 months after that 12 weeks of medication. But in general, these are very short trials, and they're also based on follow-up rates that tend to decline over time, especially 6 months out from the actual study period. And so there are plenty of limitations with that design. Alternatively, the other category of studies are observational studies, and this is of that format. We were using insurance claims from Medicaid for 12 million beneficiaries over 5 years in a handful of anonymously reporting states, so it was very highly powered. But most of the observational studies in the literature to date are typically looking at electronic health record data, so EHR data from a particular healthcare system or a treatment program, perhaps from a SAMHSA data set looking at publicly funded treatment. And one of the benefits of using insurance claims data, in this case Medicaid claims, is that we can look at these patients in terms of where they're receiving services billed to Medicaid across any setting where they're receiving those services, and we're able to follow up a much higher percentage of the patients because it's not something where we have to call them to get in touch with them, you know, 6 months after they dropped out of care. We're able to see them within the claims data for the 6 months following their treatment discontinuation.
Okay, well, I think we've well established the background. So I want to get into some of the details of your research, and I'm looking specifically at figures 1 and 2 of your AJP article, which lay out the design of your study. How did you figure out what methods you wanted to use in this study?
So in epidemiological analyses of insurance claims data, typically what's important is to identify new episodes of care. And in this case, we were looking at individuals with Medicaid who had at least a 60-day period claim-free for buprenorphine before they had what we considered their index buprenorphine, the receipt of the index prescription for buprenorphine, so that we were fairly confident that these were new episodes of care. And then we identified the subset of patients who were retained in care for a minimum of 180 days or 6 months. And then we divided them into these cohorts of 6 to 9 months, 9 to 12 months, 12 to 15, and 15 to 18 months, using the 6 to 9 month group as the reference group for the others. And this was a decision specifically, as I was alluding to earlier, to study patients who are successfully returned, as we would think of as in long-term care episodes, because we know that the great majority of patients drop out within 1 to 3 months in most settings. So this really is a subset of, in some ways, unique patients who you think are more stable, long-term patients who aren't in a setting that is only using buprenorphine for detox or has restrictions on staying on the medication beyond a month or two. These are really the long-term care patients. And then we looked at their outcomes, these primary adverse events of emergency room visits, hospital admissions, the receipt of an opioid prescription, which in general is contraindicated or a marker for relapse, and also overdose. We were looking at those four adverse events in the post-discontinuation window for these cohorts.
I could just add, I think that one of the strengths of this study is that it's taking advantage of the longitudinal nature of claims data. It's very, if you're running a clinical trial, it's very difficult to keep patients in it over an extended period of time. But as because of these archival records, we have access here to their histories over an extended period of time. So it allows us to study longer durations on buprenorphine than are feasible with a randomized controlled trial with a prospective clinical trial in that way.
So let's get to the results of your study. What were the main findings with regard to adverse health outcomes after patients discontinued buprenorphine treatment?
So in brief, what we found was that there was somewhat of what I refer to as a dose-response relationship, where patients who were in care for longer periods had slightly lower odds ratios for each of these outcomes, aside from overdose, which I'll talk about in a minute. But in general, what we found was, for instance, that the longest retained cohort of 15 to 18 months had a lower likelihood of emergency department visits, a lower likelihood of hospital admissions, and a lower likelihood of receiving an opioid prescription in the 6 months following discontinuation of care. That was not true, however, for overdose. All of these cohorts had about a 5% risk of overdose, a medically treated overdose, and that means one or more medically treated overdoses in the 6 months following discontinuation. And one of the limitations of the study is that we were not able to include individuals who lost their insurance coverage or died in the 6 months following treatment discontinuation. So arguably that overdose rate is an underestimate or doesn't fully reflect the rate of overdoses occurring among the whole sample or among the whole sample we could have observed if we were able to see them even when they lost their insurance coverage. Another thing to point out is that the rates of all four of these adverse events were much, much higher than we were expecting. I was saying a moment ago that we think of this as not necessarily a unique, but in many ways an optimal population in terms of treatment responders, people who arguably have responded to buprenorphine, have stayed on it for anywhere from 6 months to up to a year and a half. And even among those patients, when they discontinued medication, we're seeing almost half of them in the emergency room within the months following treatment discontinuation, over 10% of them admitted to the hospital one or more times, over a quarter of them receiving opioid prescriptions. These are alarmingly high rates of adverse events occurring among a population that we would otherwise think of as the most stable treatment responders who are being treated for opioid use disorder.
And I think figure 3 in your article does a nice job of capturing these main points. Readers can clearly see the outcomes following discontinuation. Now, Dr. Williams, you provided a video that is online alongside your article. And in your video, you said that you and your co-authors did not expect to find such a high rate of risk of overdose following discontinuation. What are some of the implications of this finding, as well as from other conclusions that you made?
So one of the limitations of this kind of study with these kind of data is that we don't know why patients are discontinuing. And clearly, a significant percentage of the discontinuers are discontinuing in the context of relapse. We also know, and as an active clinician, I can assure you that patients on buprenorphine are often asking how much longer they have to stay on it. They're feeling financial pressures, family pressures, difficulty making appointments and continuing to refill medications. There are plenty of reasons why patients, or even very stable patients who are doing well, are motivated to eventually taper off their medication. Of course, we see this in all areas of medicine, where patients want to take as few medications as possible. And at the same time, there may also be insurance status changes or other life events that could lead a patient or provider to suggest that someone should come off of their medication. So we don't know why they're stopping the medication. But that being said, we think of this as the most stable population among patients with opioid use disorder in treatment. And yet what we see is that 5% of them have one or more overdoses following treatment discontinuation. How does that compare to overdose rates otherwise? It used to be, until fentanyl, until about 2015 or so, the field would have said that patients with OUD are an extremely high-risk group. That, you know, a lot of these patients on the street, so to speak, or colloquially, would tell you that a lot of people who are addicted to heroin, for instance, or opioids, wind up dead or in jail. And it's true, because a lot of patients do have these really horrible outcomes. It's a very lethal diagnosis, very lethal disorder. And if you look at the community in general, we think that about 1 to 2% of patients, of individuals with opioid use disorder, die every year, which is incredibly high, especially if you're thinking about people in their 20s, 30s, 40s. This is why overdose is now the number one cause of death for people under 50. So in this case, 5% is higher than what we would think of as the already elevated risk of death, elevated risk of all-cause mortality for patients with OUD in the community. So it suggests that this post-discontinuation window really is a critical window. It suggests that buprenorphine discontinuation could be a life-threatening event for a lot of patients, whether it's planned or not. Whatever the reason is, it's suggestive that this really is a high-risk window, and that is especially true for patients with psychiatric comorbidity or other substance use disorders.
So what do you think further studies should aim to explore with regard to treatment for opioid use disorder?
There's always been an interest in the addiction field in terms of patient treatment matching. So trying to have a sense of not just for populations of patients, but for an individual patient who comes into your office or into your clinic looking for care, is there a way to identify for that patient based on their demographics, based on their treatment history, based on their addiction severity or comorbidity? Can we identify what kind of treatment program, which medication, methadone, buprenorphine, a naltrexone product, which medication would be the best for that patient? How long should they be on it? This study, I think, does provide some very useful and reliable data and findings. At the same time, it opens up a host of questions that warrant many more studies.
And I think more specifically, this opens up the issue of maintenance, long-term maintenance treatment. And who are the candidates for long-term maintenance treatment, and identifying them and developing that as a concept among the wide range of prescribers of buprenorphine.
Okay, and finally, taking a step back and placing everything in context, what would you say that researchers, clinicians, and other mental health professionals can take away from your work?
I think there are several lessons. I think the most important, clearly, is that 6 months is not sufficient for the great majority of patients, and that buprenorphine, in general, is expert consensus, and as most of our studies have suggested, really should be provided long-term, if not indefinitely, for the modal patient. I think the other take-home lesson is that patients with psychiatric comorbidity clearly are at increased risk for adverse events if they were to discontinue medication treatment for opioid use disorder. And thirdly, I would say, and this is for clinicians, but especially clinician administrators and policymakers, is that any barriers, any additional costs, burdens that get in the way of patients being able to successfully stay on medication long-term are not only a hindrance to the individual patient, but really are taxing our entire healthcare system, because we're seeing these patients in the highest cost, most inefficient healthcare settings, such as emergency departments and inpatient hospital admissions. And you know, there really are hundreds of thousands of admissions or at least ED visits for overdose every year now. And this is straining our whole healthcare system. And so it's very important to get these patients into long-term maintenance care, whether it's with buprenorphine, methadone, or naltrexone. And our systems really need to be designed to support that. And in particular for payers and quality measures, things that can incentivize capitated rates or bundled rates for value-based payments to really get patients connected to evidence-based care and retain them in that care successfully. Those are really the critical challenges for the field.
Dr. Arthur Robin Williams and Dr. Mark Olson, co-authors of the lead article in our February issue on adverse health outcomes following the end of buprenorphine treatment among individuals with opioid use disorder. Thank you both for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
This concludes this episode of AJP Audio. You can rate and review the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to it. Please also visit our website, ajp.psychiatryonline.org, to check out trending articles, find CME courses, and watch videos highlighting some of our other articles. APA Publishing has other podcasts you can listen to. Psychiatry Unbound is the books podcast from APA Publishing. It's hosted by Dr. Laura Roberts, editor-in-chief of APA Books. Also check out From Pages to Practice, which reviews the latest research published in the journal Psychiatric Services. It's hosted by Dr. Lisa Dixon, editor-in-chief of the journal, along with Dr. Josh Berezin. You can subscribe to these podcasts on Apple, Google, Spotify, or on any of the popular platforms. Next month in AJP Audio, we'll talk with Dr. Ilse Grot from the University of Amsterdam about her research on the efficacy of deep brain stimulation for obsessive compulsive disorder. We hope you'll join us too. Thank you for listening.